You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Buenos dias. Good morning to you all. It is really my pleasure and an honor to kickstart this exciting session with such an eminent panel of both experts and presenters. The presentation and discussion will focus on the 2012 edition of the BLEP series, which is being released right now. And by the way, I should introduce myself just to say that I'm Daniel Kaufman from Brookings, the Global Economy Group. You hopefully all receive this impressive document. It's just out now. The BLEP, which actually stands for Brookings Latin American Economic Perspectives, it's the fourth edition, and it analyzes economic and financial trends in the region. That's the general approach from every series, but this new edition focuses in particular on the prospects for stronger financial and commercial integration ties among Latin American countries, which the report argues it would shield the countries in the region from a volatile world growing slowly nowadays, and also have some other advantages, which Eduardo will present much better than I would do. We have in front of us five eminencias here, and I say it in Spanish because the word eminencia, I think, is so much more telling and powerful than saying eminence or just expert in English. It is my duty that I've been given and asked for to introduce the main presenter, Eduardo Levigliati, and the moderator and panelist, Alejandro Werner, who Alejandro, after I step out, will moderate and provide comments as well, and then that will be followed by the other eminencias. They have all promised, as far as I understand, that we will have a very interactive session with real debate, which is what we usually do at Brookings, and it's very important. Actually, it's what we usually do throughout the Massachusetts Avenue corridor, the think tanks. Let me say a few words about Eduardo Levigliati first. I mean, there are many details in the handout for everybody, so to save time, because when we have eminencias, the bios can be very, very long and very impressive. I will just say a few things. Eduardo is a non-resident senior fellow with the Latin American Initiative here at Brookings, a professor at the University Torquato di Tella in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, where he also directed its Center for Financial Research. He was also the director of economics at CIPEC, which is Argentina's top think tank, was the head of emerging markets and Latin American research at Barclays Capital, and chief economist of the Argentinian Central Bank. Eduardo, can you raise your hand? Eduardo is seated in the middle there, and you will see his presentation very, very, very soon. In the far left from the audience side is Alejandro Werner, who is a top executive at BBVA Bancomer, where he oversees investment banking. And before that, he was professor at the Instituto de Empresa in Madrid, Spain, also served as deputy minister in the Mexican Ministry of Finance, and headed the research department at the Mexican Central Bank and at the Ministry of Finance, where he also had many other senior positions. He was also recognized a number of years ago by the World Economic Forum as a young global leader. After Eduardo's presentation, which I know is very interesting and substantive, Alejandro will formally present the three other panelists, José de Gregorio, Santiago Levy, and Moises Naim, even if none of them need a lot of introduction, frankly. But since they are eminencias and happen to be my friends as well, let me take this opportunity, without formally introducing them, to challenge them up front on a couple of dimensions before I step out and let Eduardo take over. And the challenge, I guess, is for the whole panel, including also Alejandro and Eduardo. And since this excellent report, the focus is on regional integration, then an obvious first question is going to be whether the potential gains from integration are likely to be as as vast as some analysts and experts may think. Let's keep in mind that we think, and being a Latin American myself, we think very highly of our region. It's extremely important, but we're at the end of the day in the single digits on almost every dimension in terms of share of the world economy, also in terms of population, in terms of exports, in terms of FDI, in terms of GDP. So in an increasingly globalized world, what is the extent of potential global gains of internal versus integration among the countries within the region versus the rest? Then I'm sure there are going to be also the questions of correlation versus causality. We all know, and it is and it is part of the literature, it's also in this good report, that associated with increasing integration, regional integration, for any region in the world, one finds a correlation with lots of good things in terms of economics, including growth and so on. But as economists, we always say that causality is science, correlation is superstition. So the bottom line question is there a strong evidence of causality, a direction. And then, since it's one of my pet issues, I will end with one other question, is about how realistic is a significant additional regional integration in our region, given the political economy and the politics nowadays. Isn't it the case that one of the main impediments so far for additional integration may be the troubling governance and institutional picture in some, particularly in some prominent Latin American countries nowadays? if it is the case that a large share of the countries and the regions have a governance deficit, that may impede integration and longer-term sustained growth even at the country level. I will not go into details. People like Moises may have comments about the blatant case of Venezuela, which is well known, and he will probably mince no words about other countries, I hope. And even José de Gregorio, because you're not anymore the head of the Central Bank of Chile, but you're more in a private capacity, may even comment, would be interesting to comment about Chile, which is also my country, on whether we may share the sense that, relatively speaking, it's a case study in relative good governance. But even there are clouds in the horizon and some political economy and governance challenges nowadays that may become serious impediments to the required reforms to lift its growth rate. What about Mexico, which Alejandro knows so well and which Santiago knows so well? The report is to be commended, in fact, for including in this bleb an interesting table and graph on the economic cost of violence in Mexico, the 1% a year in terms of GDP growth that is lost. But it will be, at the same time, will be very important to hear whether that continued challenge in the corruption, narco, violence nexus may not become a major obstacle for country economic progress, for FDI progress, and for additional integration. And finally, to Eduardo, a question was about to present. Let me state the obvious regarding the governance elephant in the room today, since many people are attuned to the news of the week of the day, namely the Argentinian expropriation of Spain's Repsol stake in YPF. The president of Mexico, Calderón, has already sharply condemned it, so Alejandro may also have comments, and Santiago may have comments. Is this just a blip that ought not be taken out of proportion, ought not be exaggerated, maybe something that it made sense, or Is it a rude reminder that governance does matter and does differ very vastly across countries? And in that case, wouldn't that affect also the prospects for continuing integration if those aspects of governance differ so vastly across countries? Let me stop there, because we have such an exciting panel of eminencias, and I will give them now the floor for the presentation, which will last about 15, 20 minutes, with a PowerPoint and a lot of data that Eduardo has in stock for us, and then the panelists are going to have their remarks, their comments, and then the floor will be open for everybody to discuss in an interactive fashion. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. Since I have 20 minutes to present the pages, I need to be selective. But before starting, I want you to give you sort of a perspective of the whole BLEP, which is, as you see, quite comprehensive. This is a fourth BLEP, and typically our structure is similar to this schema we have in the first slide. We have a first pages in which we look back at what happened in the last 6 months, essentially windows in which we show the data and try to single out particular trends. Then we have a new section that updates what we call the Global Wind Index, which is a way of measuring how the three main global drivers, risk appetite, global growth, and commodities affect a big chunk of Latin America, because we're referring to essentially the commodity exporters, the big countries in Latin America, LAC 7. And this will come handy to introduce my main presentation, but this is the second section in the BLEP. Then typically we have a centerpiece that tries to tackle one or two topical subjects from a looking forward, from a forward-looking perspective. And this time around, there we have already talked in past issues on macroprudential policies, exchange rate policies, Dutch disease, these type of things. And this, in this issue, we picked a subject that I think is long overdue, something that was, I would say, a fad or quite popular in the 90s. And as you will see, it's not only the subject, but the whole process of regional integration seems remained stagnant during the 2000s. And so we saw that in the current context, it was worth having a second look. And to finalize the BLEP, the report typically presents in-depth analysis of key countries in Latin America, prepared by real experts, really, local experts. And we are always honored to have some of the top-notch economists doing our work, and some of them are here. Alejandro Grisanti just arrived. He covered Venezuela. Alex Werner covered Mexico, and so forth. There is Rafael Romeu. Now we are introducing also a coverage of Cuba, which is particularly topical in this month, and Rafael was the one that actually helped us with that. So this is the complete structure of the report. And as I mentioned, I had to be selective. I will focus essentially on the core section, which this time speaks about or rather discusses the scope for further regional integration and tries to make the case that there are at least two dimensions in which further integration may be helpful for these countries in the current context. Let me go through the main arguments first, and then I'll show you some charts. And I'll try to make the point using data, the points that are made more specifically, verbally in the report. The line of the story is essentially this one. If you look at the world right now and compare with the past decade, it looks like the global backdrop is not going to be as supportive as in the 2000s. That's not new. But even for a forward-looking perspective, it doesn't look like it's going to improve significantly looking forward. What I'm trying to say is that even though nobody expects a collapse or another Lehman, the fact is that the commodity boom, the increase in commodity prices, the level of global growth generally will be below the ones that we saw in the past decade. And to that we have to add that the growth in Latin America had created its own demands. So even if we were having this support from the global context, we still need to change our approach to growth simply because the low-hanging fruits of the recovery have been already reaped, and we now have a growing middle class. We now have more sophisticated demands that the standard pattern of the at least in the commodity exporting countries will not be able to meet in the next years. So, against that backdrop, I think regional trade and regional integration is one factor that can help remodel or reshape the pattern, the growth pattern in Latin America. And then we have a few arguments that I want to illustrate further. The first one is that, of course, regional integration has been stagnating in the past decade. We'll show you that it didn't go anywhere, but more importantly, it's starting from a very low level, comparatively speaking. You know, if you compare Latin America, either the regional trade agreements or South America and Central America as regions, and geographical regions, with Asia or Europe, or even NAFTA, North America, then we see that the region has been lagging behind very clearly. And there are a number of reasons that we explore in the report. Another argument to advocate further regional integration is the fact that trade integration, in principle, at least by increasing output correlation with the region, can link individual countries in the region to a region, Latin America, that is, at least in expectations, is likely to outgrow, to outperform the world. Simply saying that you want to link with the regions in the world that will grow faster. And, of course, Asia is one of them, at least at the current context. But Europe and the U.S. are growing less than before and, you know, are growing at the volatile rates, then having closer ties with Latin America, which looks more solid, can help mitigate the effect of a volatile global context. A third argument in favor of further integration is the fact, and I'll show you this very interesting, the fact that typically regional trading is more resilient to global collapses, and we will look how this is true for Latin America and for Asia, particularly looking at what happened in the recent crisis, but also have evidence in the report looking at past crises, past trade collapses, global trade collapses. And finally, we believe, and that's maybe provocative because it's something that has to be studied further, but we believe that regional trade, through both an effect on the composition of trade and on economies of scale, regional trade integration can foster specialization away from a model that looks increasingly, I would say, China-dependent, but that's sort of a simplification, but a model that essentially consists of exporting natural reserves, resource-intensive products, and importing pretty much everything else. If we look at the composition of regional trade, you will see that regional trade in principle has a higher degree of sophistication. And one could speculate that through regional trade, these countries can start building a more sophisticated basket of exports prior to going to the world. That's, in a sense, trying to answer one of Danny's concerns, you know, how to reconcile globalization with the fact that regional integration is, in a sense, limiting globalization by focusing on the region. I think the region may be thought as a first step towards, you know, going out in the world. Something that is not new, actually. I think this is one of the arguments for regional integration, and long-dated argument actually pushed integration in the 90s, in the 80s, and particularly in the 90s. So these are the arguments. This is the data. First thing, as an introduction, I mentioned that things in the global context don't look that well. We have many ways to show this, and have many charts associated with this one, but this is sort of a summary statistic. We constructed a what they call a global wind index to measure whether we have tailwinds or headwinds coming from what we call global drivers, essentially risk appetite as measured by, say, spreads or volatility. You know, the VIX is one of the typical risk measures, global risk appetite measures. We have a global growth index that is essentially conflating G7, growth in G7 countries and in China separately because they don't tend to correlate so much. And the third factor is commodities. And we have like a commodity index and we put everything together, calibrate to the sixth largest country. We exclude Venezuela because Venezuela is typically characterized by idiosyncratic factors. We put the six largest countries plus Uruguay and we calibrate the index to approximate their growth patterns, and that's what we get, essentially. You know, there are two lines there. One, the smoother one, is the index. The more volatile one is the growth of these countries, essentially, growth of the region. And it correlates relatively well, and that tells us, by looking at expectations about these three factors, you know, risk, commodities, and growth in the rest of the world, it allows us to sort of depict what we think is going to be the case, what is going to be the global context in the near term. And the picture is a little bit like that. I mean, if you look at the period, I mean, there's a problem here because we don't have the years, but I can tell you which one is. You can tell it from the big decline is essentially associated with the end of 2008, and the year 2009, which is associated with the crisis. Then you have the recovery. You see the pre-crisis level was relatively high, and the recovery period was also high because we were essentially catching up, recovering from the crisis. If you look forward, the level of the index is still positive, but it's not as high as before. That implies that as a support, it will be a weaker support than it was prior to the crisis. That means that not that this is going to drag down the growth in Latin America. It means that it will push much less than before. So instead of corresponding to a growth rate of 4.5, now we're talking about a growth rate in Latin America associated with this index of 2.5-3%. So we have less of a tailwind. That's what I'm trying to say. So in that context, the question is whether the region can make up for what I call the global debt can. You know, this fact that you don't have a tailwind or a headwind, but you know, just you're coasting by yourself, and the focus turns to local policies and local factors or regional factors. Now, I mentioned that regional trade integration was lagging behind other regions or other areas, and here we are comparing exports and imports within either regional trade agreements or areas in 2003 and 2010 to just compare how this evolved over the years, and we are comparing different regions just to see cross-country how it looks. And the regions are, the trade agreements are Mercosur, NAFTA, SA means South America, that's a geographical reason, just to see whether Mercosur improves upon South America. It's interesting that you see there is no difference between the two. So the fact that you have a regional trade agreement there didn't imply that we are more integrated in practice. Then CAN is the Andean Community, the Andean Pact. The MCCA is Central America. That is a trade agreement, trade area in Central America. ASEAN is the Asian countries, small Asian countries. ASEAN plus three is small Asian countries plus Japan, China, and Korea. And then we have the European Union. And if you compare, for instance, Mercosur, South America, or the Andean Community, or Central America with Asia and Europe, you see the difference. You see that the trade integration is essentially less than half of what you find in Europe or Asia. Interestingly, NAFTA, and we discussed that in the paper, in the report, NAFTA actually looks more integrated, but essentially because of a particular trade links between Mexico and the U.S., which we'll talk about this in a minute, but it's an outsider in any respect because you know, it's essentially the reflection of a complementarity between the U.S. and Mexico based, among other things, in a very wide dispersion in relative factor endowments, essentially, you know, skilled labor, you know, wages. There is a big complementarity. It's a particularly strong trade relationship that, interestingly and importantly for our analysis, brings Mexico closer to the U.S. and farther away from what we call the Latin American region. And one implicit question in our analysis is whether Latin America, in fact, can be thought of as a region, and we have to concentrate on, say, South America. We were talking about trade integration. But anyway, so you see, trade links are actually lagging behind Europe and Asia and have been stagnating in the sense that they haven't been converging to those levels. So the natural question is why? And we have a few hypotheses there. One of them is that our trade links, our trade flows are essentially final goods, but we don't have, as is the case clearly in Europe and in Asia, particularly in Asia plus the three big countries, we don't have a lot of intra-industry trade, meaning essentially the reflection of industries that are disseminated within the region and explode economies of scope and explode the differences in factor endowment to trade between each other, you know, to distribute the production process in different countries of the region. We don't have that, and we try to illustrate this fact by, for instance, constructing this standard, although not particularly intuitive, Grubel-Lloyd index, which essentially measures the index essentially high whenever the net exports for a particular good, a particular sector, are relatively low relative to the gross exports. So in that sense, what it's trying to measure is whether if I'm trading, I'm selling to you things from the same sector you're selling to me, which is the case if you have intra-industry trade. You know, the same industry exports and imports from the countries in the area. So a high number would mean a more intense intra-industry flows, and a low number means the opposite. And if you look at either individual Latin American countries or a comparison between, say, Latin America, LAC 7, with Europe and particularly Asian, ASEAN plus 3, which is the big Asian area, we are, again, lagging behind. You know, if you think of Europe, trading Europe on trade in Asia is essentially, for the most part, intra-industry trade. In Latin America, we have the opposite. You know, we sell something to another country, and the other country sells something completely different to us. But there is not the same. There is no multi-Latinas that trade with each other across the whole area. That's the whole point. Right? Why? One of the answers that we suggest in the report is that, as I mentioned before, our countries may be not only too small, which are, but also too similar. I mean, why don't we have these corporations, the regional corporations, the multilatinas? Why are they so few? Of course, scale is an issue, but also if you look at the dispersion in terms of income, GDP per capita, skilled labor, and wages within each of these regions, you will see that, for instance, the LAC 7 are much more similar than, say, NAFTA or the European Union or Asia. A larger number means a larger standard deviation, means that wages or incomes are more dispersed, more diverse. And that means that these complementarities I was speaking before, that I, for instance, do my labor-intensive part of the production in a country that has lower wages, and I do my more sophisticated and skilled labor-intensive section or capital-intensive section in another country that have a skilled labor or higher income and higher access to capital, then in Latin America, this scope for diversification, geographical diversification, is much more limited. So that's one possible reason why we don't have this intra-industry trade that is so typical in Europe and Asia. Now, there is another hypothesis that we proposed in the paper, I think is important, has to do with the whole motivation of the study, essentially pointing at the effect of imagination, particularly China. We call it the China effect, although this is a simplification because the pattern is also present in the region's trade with the rest of the world. And these charts are trying to illustrate that, the fact that the region essentially exports natural resource-intensive products and imports pretty much everything else. That's, again, it's a simplification, but if you look at, for instance, the share of manufacturers in extra-regional exports for the region, is the red line, and you compare this with, say, Mexico, which is NAFTA in this case, Europe or Asia, you see that the degree of the share of manufacturers that we are exporting to the rest of the world is relatively lower, much lower. And we are importing a lot of manufacturers here. This is the imports. These are the imports from the rest of the world to the region. If you look at the same thing within the region, the trade is much more balanced. So here we have exactly the same charts, but this corresponds to the regional trade, intra-regional trade. So if you look at what we export, say, for instance, Brazil to the rest of South America or imports from South America to Brazil, the share of manufacturing is relatively equal, although still much lower than before because, again, we are exporting, particularly Latin America is exporting to themselves and to the rest of the world, particularly natural resource-intensive products. So composition is an issue here. And the story behind this is that you may think of emerging Asia and the demand from China as a centrifugal force against the build-up of this multi-Latina, simply because it's much simpler or more profitable in the short run to concentrate on the production of natural resource intensive products that don't require this degree of regional diversification or the build-up of big multi-Latinas, big firms that distribute their product within the region according to differential factor endowments. In fact, it's much easier to export. If you export soy, essentially Brazil, Argentina will export soybeans to China, and there is no need to trade anything in between. It's just a direct export to emerging Asia. And that may be deterring, discouraging the build-up of these big conglomerates that are at the basis of intra-regional trade. I mentioned that one of the arguments for further integration was the fact that you want to have correlation with regions that are actually likely to grow. This is not new. There are a bunch of papers written on this. It's just an updating of an old say that says that your output, your correlation with the countries to which you trade are typically higher than the correlation with the countries that you don't trade with. And here what I'm showing essentially is for each of these Latin American countries, each point is a country. I'm showing on the x-axis the trade integration, essentially the share of the exports that go to Asia in the first chart, Latin America in the second, and United States in the third one, and how this share that goes to the region correlates with the correlation of cyclical output with the cyclical output of the region. In other words, an upward sloping line implies that the more integrated I am, the more correlated I am with that particular region. And you see it works for the three areas, and in particular it's telling me that if I trade more with Latin America, for good or bad, I will be more correlated with Latin America. And if I believe that Latin America is a better trade partner, it's a better looking, has a higher, brighter growth prospects, probably I would like to trade more with Latin America or with Asia and less with the United States or with the European Union. And to do that, regional integration helps. I mentioned also an additional reason why we would like to have a further integration with the region in the event of a very volatile global context is that regional trade, for many reasons, some of them are essentially mentioned in the report, regional trade tend to be more resilient to global trade collapses. What I mean by this, if you take the evolution of regional trade, of regional trading, regional trade flows starting from the trade collapse at the beginning of 2009, and move forward, we see that the recovery was much faster for regional trades than for extra-regional trade flows. And the same happened with imports, and the same happened for Asia, even more clearly. If you see, the upper line is essentially trades to the region, the exports to the region, and the lower line is the downward sloping line is trade to the rest of the world. The trade in the rest of the world didn't recover after the fall. This is starting right at the bottom of the collapse, whereas the trade flows to the region recovered rather rapidly. So, in a sense, if we are in a world in which another trade collapse or trade flows in general are subject to this external volatility, for some reason our regional trade is a little bit more immunized against these shocks. We can count on our neighbors for a number of reasons, including probably the fact that trade credit and trade finance is easier within the region than internationally. There are a bunch of potential hypotheses that explains this. But the fact is that regional trade tend to be more resilient, more robust in the case of big global shocks. why don't we have more financial trade integration in the region? That's something that we tried to answer at the end of this first part of this section. There are a number of hypotheses. Institutions are one of them. We don't touch on that so much, but I know that José de Gregorio had worked on this, and in fact has a paper, has some results that are comparable to ours, and I think he focused on institutions and governance as part of the reason why we are lagging behind integration relative to the rest of the world. We propose a few other potential candidates to explain this. We need to understand the reasons if we want to actually further integration. And one of the reasons I mentioned before, you know, the attraction of emerging Asia or China. If you look at how the composition of exports, the geographical composition, have changed over the decade, you see that the only one that's actually growing very rapidly is the share that goes to Asia. And that chart, I have to add, includes Mexico. If you take out Mexico, this is even clearer because Mexico actually has a very strong, you know, share, very high share that goes to the U.S. and it's been growing. So one question would be, one topic to debate at least would be whether the short run appeal of selling to China is working against our long run benefits in terms of further trade integration, and if some policy action is needed to correct this possible distortion in the sense of creating incentives to these centrifugal incentives to produce natural resource-intensive products and concentrate increasingly on a particular region. There is another aspect that we emphasize in the discussion. It has to be with leadership, and there is a long discussion. To make this discussion shorter, I wanted to show you this chart, essentially comparing what is called the trade interdependence of, in this case, the largest economy within a region. Particularly, the question here is, why isn't Brazil more interested in furthering, in strengthening trade links within the regions, being Brazil the largest economy within South America, at least? And we compare the trade interdependence of Brazil, in this case, which is the border line, the blue line, with the same measure for each of the other areas. And particularly important, look at the light blue line and this one here, which I don't know, it's also blue, that corresponds to Germany. What is trade interdependence? It's a complicated formula that essentially measures the ratio between what I export to the rest of the region over what the rest of the region exports to me. And if I'm exporting a lot to the region, like in the case of Germany, for instance, I would be more interested. That's what the hegemon theory of trade integration postulates. I would be more interested in ensuring that you have the institutions and the arrangements to facilitate integrations. Whereas if I don't export a lot, or if essentially I receive exports, but I'm exporting somewhere else, like Brazil, for instance, probably due to the increasing importance of China in its trade flows, then I simply don't care. And one question is whether, you know, this actually is working against further integration, whether, again, some policy debate should be done to make the leader care. And this, in fact, in the report, we show another chart in which the second largest economy in the areas also present the same pattern. Argentina also doesn't care, because it's essentially the same thing. Argentina is exporting a lot to the rest of the world, particularly emerging Asia, so they don't care so much about furthering and enlarging the market, the Mercosur in particular, and South America in general. So there might be some political underpinnings to this underwhelming results instead of regional trade integration. So the arguments again, just to conclude this part of the section of the presentation, regional trade integration has been stagnant and has been lagging behind other areas, particularly Europe and Asia, but also North America. I mean, there is a obvious question whether North America has to be considered an area, whether Mexico belongs to Latin America or North America, something that I probably would like to leave for Alex to discuss. But you know, if you look at trade flows, clearly Mexico and North America, and the U.S. constitute an area that is comparable with Asia and is farther away and much more intense than the rest of Latin America. Second argument, trade integration can link output to the winners, assuming that Latin America will be among the winners, which is conventional wisdom right now, but, you know, you never know. But then, you know, in principle, we would say that Latin America looks stronger looking forward than Europe or the U.S. Third argument, regional trade is more resilient to global volatility in trade flows. And finally, regional trade through composition and economies of scale can foster specialization away from this China-dependent model that had characterized the past decade. Those are our arguments for further integration. Our conclusion at least is that we should have policies that specifically try to strengthen regional trade. The second part of the core section, which I will go over very quickly, tackles another dimension, very specific dimension of regional integration, which is integration of reserves, put it very simply, or the integration of global safety nets. The integration of safety nets, you know, the build-up of a regional safety net. The global safety net, financial safety net, essentially refers to the presence of an international lender of last resort that can provide liquidity in the event of a global financial collapse, something that the IMF have been trying to do for the past 10 years and more recently have been trying to improve on facilities that provide this liquidity, this emergency liquidity for countries that suffer a contagion from financial crisis elsewhere. Right? All these flexible credit lines and global stabilization mechanisms that have been proposed by the IMF are trying to fill that gap, presumably to deter the very rapid accumulation of precautionary reserves in emerging economies. Now, the question with the IMF, something that has been discussed even in our labs before, is that because of moral hazard considerations, those facilities are not strictly automatic, so you have to request that, and requesting something from the IMF has a strong political stigma. So ultimately, these facilities, although they have been improved over time, they haven't been used or have been used very scarcely. So they don't. If something is not attractive from a political perspective, it's not going to be used during a crisis, then it's almost as if it were not there. Now, where is this discussion right now? Well, in some of the most recent proposals by the IMF, the institution recognizes that the next step is that this is as much as far as it can go, and the next step has to be the articulation of this whatever safety net the IMF can propose with the regional arrangements that are already in place in Asia, in Latin America, and probably due to the recent crisis in Europe. And this regional articulation requires to have, you know, a regional agreement in which, you know, countries within a region pool reserves and possibly go to the IMF or some of the international financial community to get emergency assistance if those reserves that are pooled are not enough during a crisis. So the question is whether there is scope for further integration, for deepening of these regional pools within the region. There is one there, and that the whole section, this whole part of the section actually refers to that one, which is the Latin American Reserve Fund, the FLAR, which is already working. It's very small. It comprises a few Andean countries, but that, in essence, is a symmetrical reserve pool. Countries commit a given amount of reserves and are allowed to withdraw, to borrow for up to 2.5 the amount of reserves that are committed, right? Now, I believe that this can be deepened. This FLAR, the Latin American Reserve Fund, can be extended to include all Latin American, or at least South American countries, and can be made more reliable by having some big countries as lenders within the fund. If you compare the Latin American Reserve Fund with the Asian peer, the Chiang Mai Initiative, which is, again, it's a network of central bank currency swaps in which clearly there are two, three countries that are lenders within this scheme, you know, China, Japan particularly. Then one thing is very obvious. If you look at FLAR, and compare it with the Chiang Mai initiative, is that if there is a crisis, all countries within FLAR will need the reserves at the same time, and if everybody is allowed to borrow 2.5 whatever they committed, simply there are not enough reserves for everybody. So that's one of the key flaws of the FLAR, something that actually people at the IMF have been pointing out when Latin Americans try to make the case for a better FLAR. Now, we acknowledge that problem, which we call the correlation risk, the fact that reserve declines are correlated in the case of a global crisis. But we try to make the point also that there are advantages within these regional pools that can be exploited, even though there is this limitation of the absence of a lender of last resort. In fact, an issuer of last resort like Japan in Asia, for instance, somebody that can issue in the middle of a crisis because it's benefited by the flight to quality typical of a global financial crisis. So I don't have time to show all of this. I mean, the correlation between reserve movements increasing in a crisis is pretty obvious. You know, if you look at Latin America, everybody was having exchange rate pressures in 2009 simultaneously. So it makes sense to see how the correlation between the reserve changes increases during the crisis. The difference between the FLAR and the CMI is that if you put all reserves together, FLAR was losing reserve all over the all countries within the FLAR were losing reserves in 2009. Even if we include Brazil and Mexico and Chile, you would have these countries suffering exchange rate pressures, whereas if you look at the CMI, the total reserves were relatively flat during the crisis because Japan was gaining reserves because, you know, the yen is one of these safe haven currencies, and capital outflows from the rest of the regions were, in fact, part of it, a big chunk of it was feeding into capital inflows in Japan. So if you pull everything together, the fact is that you have the reserve to blend back. You know, these inflows to Japan can be lent to the countries within the Asian fund, whereas in Latin America we have this problem that nobody is actually, you know, able or willing in that context to lend part of their reserves. Now, what's the good part of this? The good part of that, something that I think needs to be studied much more. The fact that if you look at, for instance, both the Latin American Reserve Fund and the and another regional multilateral organization, the CAF, which is an Andean development bank, and you compare the ratings, the credit ratings, or the borrowing costs of FLAR and CAF with those of each of their members, it's remarkable that the credit rating and the borrowing cost, the credit rating is typically higher than the best of the members, and the borrowing cost is typically lower than the most, the member with the best access to capital markets. So in a sense, multilateralization tends to reduce the, enhance access to markets and reduce the borrowing cost, and particularly reduce what's called the carrying cost of reserves. If I need to borrow money to hoard reserves, it would be cheaper to do it through a reserve pool than doing it individually. Based on this trade-off between the absence of an issue of last resort and the fact that you can actually access markets in a better position by multilateralizing these reserve hoardings, we made a few recommendations. Particularly, we proposed that the FLAR should be recapitalized, that it should be made truly Latin America, or at least South America. I don't know whether Mexico would be interested in joining the FLAR, because it has a sort of special relationship with the U.S., but the rest of Latin America, I think, may improve by joining the FLAR in a way that is closer to the Chiang Mai initiative, in a way in which some large countries can borrow less than the countries that are more needy in the case of a global turmoil. And, of course, one thing that needs to be done is to formalize the rules of engagement. You know, today everybody can borrow almost automatically, and that, of course, if you expand this to a large amount of borrowing, can increase credit risk for the whole institution. So you need to have eligibility rules, something that the Asians are working right now. In Chiang Mai initiative typically was accessed through an IMF program, and that actually killed the initiative, since nobody wanted to go through the IMF to request assistance from Chiang Mai. Now they realize that, and they're trying to move towards something as close to an Asian IMF, an Asian Monetary Fund, which is called the Asian Monetary Research Authority or something like that, AMRO, that's essentially the seat for having an institution, local institution, that do the eligibility process and the surveillance and replace the IMF. But again, something like that should be done. Otherwise, you know, automatic access for everybody can increase credit risk at the point at which the lender countries will no longer participate. And finally, one important thing, I think that going back to the recommendations by the IMF itself, FLAR or regional agreements like that can be probably the best and the only vehicle to articulate the international financial community, the liquidity of these global lenders with the countries in regions like Latin America that don't count with an issuer in a moment of a crisis, an issuer within the region. So it would be probably easier to borrow through FLAR in the case, from the IMF through FLAR in the case of a crisis, and asking the countries to go and request individually a program, access to the facilities of the IMF. So four recommendations, and finally I close with these two questions that I think are behind, underlying the whole report, which is whether Latin America can and is ready to work together after all, and whether Latin America is a region. I have strong doubts about the concept of Latin America. I think it has to be revisited, if we can still think of Latin America, or we can have to start thinking about South America and Central America and Mexico in specific ways. But those are open questions. I want to stop here. I think I spoke too much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Eduardo. I think we had a very thought-provoking presentation. And, I mean, I won't introduce the panel. The panel was introduced as having three eminencias here. All of you know our panelists today, and I think they're pretty well-suited to analyze these two issues of trade and financial integration. And I think hopefully we will have a discussion that focuses first on the technical aspect, on whether, first, I think we have a policy framework that is biased against integration. I think that might be an interesting thing to understand, if actually policymakers in Latin America had created a policy framework that actually works against financial integration and trade integration, that I think it doesn't make any sense to bias your policy setting away from intra-regional issues. Secondly, I think it would be interesting to know whether it makes sense to bias the policy framework in the other direction. That, I mean, one of the conclusions that we might think the study brings is that maybe we should strive to sign free trade agreements to extend Mercosur to the whole region, etc., therefore creating a policy framework that is biased to generate a larger trade integration. And I don't know if this makes sense or not. So I think that would be another interesting area where the panel should focus. And I think also it will be very relevant to think if we are at a point in time in which trade integration is even actually in the agenda of anyone in Latin America, if financial integration through policy instruments such as the FLAR are being thought by anybody in the region, and if, given what we are seeing in the region, does it make sense to push for something like this? And I think at this point, what we are seeing is that first, economies in Latin America are being subject to a very different set of stimulus, depending if you are in Central America, South America, etc. I mean, part of Latin America is being driven more by the commodity cycle, and part of Latin America is driven much more by developments in the U.S. Secondly, I mean, we are seeing very divergent policy frameworks in Latin America. We're seeing a group of countries who have, I think, taken as a lesson from the crisis that obviously we should focus much more on financial regulation, et cetera, the topics that were at the core of the international financial crisis. However, that we should strive to strengthen the openings of some of these economies to provide, I think, an impulse for productivity and growth. And I think there are another set of countries that have taken as a lesson from the crisis that should even move your policy framework to a more protective policy framework, to a more local base in terms of capital provision, integration with the rest of the economy, basically to restrict the integration of the economy, of your economy, to the world economy. So, inside this framework, I think it's hard to think that you can have the incentives in an important number of countries in Latin America to strive to push for a policy agenda that would look for trade and financial and financial integration. And then you have even not only on the ideological front, but in terms of policy implementation, I think some countries in the region have been responding to the international currency wars with, I would say, with local regional trade battles. So, in this environment, I think it's actually, I think that this report is very good, just to focus the discussion on the other direction, signaling the benefits of integration, et cetera, when we are seeing a response to external shocks, basically on the financial front, with some of these Latin American countries responding with protectionist initiatives against countries in Latin America. So I think, making an important argument on the other side, on the side of trade opening, integration, it's very good at this point in time, because we are gradually moving on the opposite direction, and I think it's a very dangerous move that the region is taking. On the financial front, I think technically it makes a lot of sense, the arguments we heard on the floor. And if we had Eduardo Levy sitting on the board of every central bank in Latin America, maybe we should be discussing that. However, again, policy objectives of central banks in Latin America are so divergent that if we really want to strive for the objectives that were posed on the presentation, maybe we should be thinking of sitting down and talking with the IMF on a redesign of the flexible credit line that is targeted to the objectives that the region wants to achieve. I think we need to import an institutional setup for these type of frameworks that is already being designed by somebody else that has a stronger institutional underpinnings than one that we have in the region that is very weak, where extremely divergent policy views are being implemented. And finally, I think in all these topics of regional integration, we have a very divergent set of policy frameworks in the region currently. Secondly, we don't have, and I'm thinking Europe 20 or 25 years ago, the pool of a center of gravity such as Germany, where a lot of the countries, even though not fully accepting all the policy framework in Germany, wanted to gravitate toward interest rates in Germany. So there was a strong pull to accommodate the shape of policy making in Europe to achieve financial integration with Germany that we don't see now in Latin America. So, being, I guess, a little bit negative and skeptical on regional integration being driven by, let's say, a policy initiative. Now, I think what we're seeing is the private sector integrating much more in Latin America. Mexico, we're seeing recently Colombian companies coming in, buying pension funds in all of Latin America, buying one of the largest pension funds in Mexico. We're seeing Brazilian banks looking over the Mexican financial system. We're seeing Mexican telecoms going all over the region. We're seeing firms on food and beverages going all over the region. So I think, although maybe the the policy framework will not be fully incentivizing this movement, I think the private sector has realized that for the next decade we will have a very invigorated region, a very strengthening of domestic demand on these countries. We have some common cultural elements. We have important historical relationships that, and we have a lot of similarities that makes, I mean, a very logical region to expand your business. And we are seeing this move being driven, I think, much more by the private sector than by policy initiatives. So I think along these lines, and maybe the last topic is diplomacy and geopolitical issues in each of these countries. And I think on that line also we see key divergences. I mean, we see some countries in the region looking much more to Asia, to China, to the BRICS, other countries in Central and North America looking to the U.S., and in that sense also, I haven't seen regional integration again, not even in the agenda of finance ministers and central bankers, and I think that it's not in the agenda of our foreign ministries as well. So I think we have a lot to talk about on the merits of the policies, but also on the possibilities of pushing ahead an integration agenda in Latin America, given where Latin America policymaking is today. Thank you. So we might start in alphabetical order with Jose first. Go ahead. De Gregorio.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. It was great to read the blep. There are so many acronyms. And this reminds me because in the mid-2000s, I was doing a paper on Latin American growth and no growth, and I started looking at the same numbers, the comparison of trade, intra-regional trade. And I was extremely surprised that South America had currently about 20% of this trade is intra-regional. That was the standard for Asia in the 60s. And then looking at data, Latin America was much more in the 60s in terms of integration than most of the regions today. I found, for example, that North America, they trade among themselves almost a third, East Asia 50%, 60%, depending on how you measure. Europe 70%, but for them now, but it's 70%, and advanced economy 60%. So I started thinking about this, and all my trade friends told me, well, but this is because of factor endowment, Hitcherlin, and remind me all of the things that we learned, and we have forgotten a little bit on trade. And I think that Eduardo has made a very good job even providing some evidence on factor endowments and differences across countries. However, this was 2005, and I thought about two things. First, that poor Bolivar, that always tried to have one region, an integrated region, and since Bolivar, we haven't succeeded. And I haven't done the research. It's very difficult to do it also because it's the acronym, not just the BLEP. There are so many acronyms for agreements that we have in Latin America. Mercosur, ALALC, ALADI. And when you are public official, you have to go with the guy next to you that's telling you what means each acronym because you have a meeting with a who knows. So who are they? So they tell you a story that in the 70-something they create this new agreement and there are some diplomats there and people say, well, Bolivar. So, but we haven't succeeded. And it's a very tough question. And there are things that has to do with, and you would think, we don't need too many regressions just to say, well, if countries can trade with their partners, it's kind of the first way to go. And then you start conquering the world. But then I say, why? So beyond all the trade complaints, I say, because there is no, I think that I like Mexicans. And Alejandro put it very well, there are divergences. I think there is no trust in Latin America. So this was 2005. When Chile had a spike in energy prices because we have some agreement, there is all the discussion, with Argentina on gas. And now, the price of energy went up in Chile, and there was a huge discussion because Argentina had no gas, so they needed gas for them and all that. And at the same time, Bolivia said, well, and we will never sell gas to Chile. So we said, okay, that's fine. So, and then we come today. And today, it's not just Mexican problem cars with problems in Argentina and Brazil, despite having a lot of free trade agreements. This is not just despite Uruguay signed a free trade agreement. Mercosur is full member of Mercosur. They didn't go in a trade agreement with the U.S. to be Mercosur because Bolivar. So at the end, to blame is Bolivar. The problem was Bolivar. So they didn't go. And now they have a lot of trade restrictions from Argentina, the partner. So this is, it's unbelievable. So I have to say, Argentina's maybe right. I don't know. But this, the fact is that it's very difficult to do business in the region. So where you push it, how you do it, and it's quite difficult. It's quite complicated, especially because the BLEP has a very good point. Say, what you do is basically you integrate manufacturing. So you produce part in different regions, in different countries. So, but to get stuck with your parts, it's quite a problem. With the corks for the wine bottles of the other country, and to get a lot of corks, is so better you do the corks and the bottles and everything. So I think that, no, I'm very serious about this, because I think that we have, and I think that Moises and people that knows more about the politics in the world can help, but I really think that we are quite special. Then it happens the following. Then we go to meetings, to international meetings, and we want to talk about trade integration. And appears a big country that says, no, but the problem is that there is a currency war. And all the discussion during 3 days is whether in the communique there will be a mention or not to the currency war, when we're just trying to reach an agreement to trade among ourselves. So it's quite, this is what Alejandro has called divergence. So we have a lot of divergence, but I think that it's very difficult to trade when institutions are weak, when there is a lot of disparities, and when there is no, we cannot build trust. And I think that it's pretty bad. I think that's pretty bad. I'm not making big fuss about this. I think that it's very bad. It's very bad for the region, for the abilities. I am extremely optimistic, and I have to be, since I'm not a public official and can say no, I'm extremely optimistic about the Chile, Peru, Colombia, Mexico possibilities, and Uruguay. But we have problems even with countries that are so successful, like even Brazil, but to reach agreements that really can have long duration and be very strong. So I think that this is what struck me many years ago, and I still think that it has to be with institutions, with things that go much more beyond the issues about more trade explanation. There's one thing that is also interesting, and I was thinking while Eduardo was talking, it is bad to do commodities or standardized product. We tend to say, well, we specialize in commodities, they are lousy, they are bad, this is like the old thing, we should do electronics. This was kind of the 20 years ago things, very sophisticated electronics, because copper is lousy, but it's quite expensive. So the issue is, but there is one thing in trade, which is the crisis has shown, and you can show even, you can see even in the collapse of trade around the world, the countries that were more hit were the countries more industrial, because they were part of the machine around the world. They were producing part for European cars and from here. And Asia was collapsing, and many countries collapsing. But when you produce a bottle of wine, you just, instead of selling in Europe, you put it somewhere else. It's kind of easy. So I'm a bit, sometimes I have to say I'm a bit skeptical about. I just want to provoke a bit of discussion. I'm a bit skeptical about the thing that saying this. These things are kind of low sophistication, they're lousy. So, and sophistication, for example, in the wine industry, is not to have all wines may be the same at the end, but the distribution, the marketing, is an amazing thing that you have to do. So you say, no, but it's not a BlackBerry, which is doing pretty bad. That's in a way. And finally, regarding to FLAR, this is the other thing, the Bolivar. Bolivar was first trade, now it's finance. Let's do. The flash story comes from the Chan Mei initiative that was, let's get, Asia said, let's get rid of the IMF because they really did very bad with us in the 90s. This is the standard view of my Asian friends. Let's get rid of. So let's do our pooling of reserves, let's do an initiative, and we do our own IMF. We have never used it, but let's do our own. So they say, well, Latins, we say, well, okay, let's do the same. They are Asians and they are doing fine. I have some concerns about this. First, do we want, and this has to do with the which I am very critical about the contingent credit lines of the IMF. Do we want to get rid of the possibility of accumulating reserves? I would say no. Why? Because if we contract a flexible credit line with IMF, or we have a pool of reserves, small pool of reserves compared to our own reserves, at the FLAR, we won't have the excuse to accumulate reserves and to defend our exchange rate. That's what we do in Latin America, everywhere, all countries. All countries accumulate reserves to prevent a sudden stop, and then we have and run regressions. But we want that one reason, when there is a strong mercantilistic reason for accumulating reserves, which is avoiding an appreciation. Temporary, we do it in a very rule base in Chile because we are more orthodox, people do it. But that's what we want. So accumulating reserve have two purposes, self-insurance and currency. If we separate this and we say, well, we have a good insurance, we have great insurance, we lost the ability to say we will accumulate reserves now to defend the currency. So first thing, I think that I like to have reserves. I think that we should accumulate all the creations, and they have fiscal impact. I fully agree. I won't discuss that. But all of the discussion about finding instrument to have less reserves, it's sort of self-defeating with the currency issue. So we spend, and we have tons of conference on contingency. But countries, second, I had this discussion. This is an issue that I discussed with some Asian friends, with Takahito, Barry Aiken, about pooling reserves. They were much in favor of that. Then we were discussing governance. How we do with governance? How we do with governance? Let's say in Latin America we have $3 trillion. We sit on all our reserves are together at the FLAR, and we sit. And then there is a country that says, I need the reserves. And then we said, we'll do conditionality. We'll put the guys with the black, you know, a briefcase going to the country and say, well, you have to do this, or we'll do it the Latin way. So it's a governance is a mess. Governance is a mess. Because then there is the divergence that my Mexican friend said. There is the divergence. There is a country in Latin America that wants reserves not because of exchange rate problems or current account. Wants reserves in order to do more spending. So. Can now a country come and say there will be $2 trillion now to do spending? I will recognize the country. There was a forum in Latin America. I received a lot of letters. I never went. But they want to pull reserves in order to finance infrastructure. So what we're talking about? I think that I love FLAR. I think that FLAR and CAF are one of the best institutions well run in the region. I think that FLAR is very good to manage reserves, to do technical advice. I didn't do it, but I was when I was governor, I tried to get into FLAR because I think that they do a great contribution to the region. I think that technical assistance, we were trying to create a Latin American bond fund and trying to do some form of integration that is very little scope, but that can help to do better integration than we have the Banco del Sur. We have so many things in the region that it really scares me to now say, well, now $2 trillion at the FLAR. So I think that it's not, we can try hard, but I think that in practical, trying to replicate, we have to think if we really want to build trust in the region, what we have to do is small steps, very humble, but that really help us to think that despite all the divergence, we can have some common goals. And that, I think, that we'll see will be what will help us to build the trust in order to have a better region, more integrated.
Thank you, Jose. And before going with Santiago, I think I need to say that it's good to have Jose de Gregorio back after many years of being a central banker without being able to talk, and now we have heard him in all his color, and I think it's very good to have you back with a very clear opinion. Santiago.
Thank you, Alejandro. Well, good morning to everybody, and let me begin by thanking Eduardo Levi-Yati and Brookings for inviting me to the event, and congratulate Eduardo and all the co-authors for the report. My take on the report is it makes one big core point with which I'm fully in agreement, and I think the core point is the next decade probably won't be as favorable to Latin America as the last decade. The tailwinds are going to slow down, and therefore we have to get our act together if we want to continue growing at the rates we were continuing growing before. And that sort of, I think, is a big point of the report, and that big point is a big point that I'm fully in agreement with. The report does mention that in previous years, Brookings has also looked at other dimensions of this issue, and in this particular issue, they're looking at the integration dimension. But it's important to put the question in the broader context, which is, this is a region for the last 10 years faced an extremely favorable set of circumstances. The index that Eduardo was showing, this kind of the direction of the wind, direction of the wind index, it was an extremely unusual set of circumstances, and it's, you never know, but it's unlikely to be repeated looking ahead. Therefore, we have to turn to the deeper structural agenda, and that, I think, is a big point. Would I put integration at the top of the structural agenda for the region? So my take on this is as follows. I would separate integration as an end in itself, Bolivar Dream and all that, which I take as really not relevant for the region, versus a more technical approach, what I would say is, what you want is a commercial policy that does not discriminate between countries, and if at present your trade agreements and your tariffs and your whole setup is such that you're biasing your trade pattern against intra-regional trade vis-a-vis the rest of the world, then you should correct that. When I look at indexes of intra-industry trade and they say, well, in Latin America it's only 20%, but in Asia it's 40%, what does that tell me? The honest truth is I don't know. Because I don't know whether the right number for Latin America is 30% or 50%. Theory would say, well, the number is whatever emerges from the region's comparative advantage in an unbiased trade setup. So the policy direction that I would suggest is do revise your arrangements, your trade arrangements and your agreements, your FTAs, and the whole bunch of FTAs that we signed over the last decades, and ensure that you're not discriminating across countries and you're not discriminating to the possibilities of trade within the region. That said, there's a very important dimension of trade that goes beyond that, which has to do with transport costs and logistics. A lot of what might not be reflected in the data is that transport costs within the region are very high, and that has been because of insufficient investment in infrastructure. And then what Eduardo is probably telling us is the region should probably invest in a lot more infrastructure internally. It would lower transport costs internally so that moving goods from Brazil to Peru, think of the distances, think of, Peru really means Lima, and Callao really means the coast, so you think you have to go over the Andes and come down the Andes, and you have to think of what does that imply in terms of transportation costs. So if you look at the geography of the region, you have to think there's a huge amount of investment in infrastructure that you would have to carry out to lower transport costs. In some work that we did at the IB, we find that about 50% of the total barriers of trade within the region is regulations, tariffs, all that stuff, and about another 50% is transport cost and logistics. So a lot could be gained simply by removing discrimination on the infrastructure side and then sort of make the trade more. Would that generate more inter-industry trade? Probably, because you'll be lowering trade cost and you'll be lowering transportation cost, and it would probably do it. But I don't like the angle of entering into from the integration perspective. That, what I said before, I like the angle more from what is happening in the productive structure of these countries that generates this pattern of locating themselves in the world comparative advantages. And I think the core issue, and this was last year's report, is, in my view, productivity. At the end of the day, what really, really matters if we're going to face winds in the world that are not going to be as favorable as they were in the past is that the region does its homework to raise total factor productivity and the deep factors that are behind very slow productivity growth. That would trigger a process of growth, and my byproduct of that process of growth would be more trade naturally because income per capita in the region would grow, firms would get larger, there would be more economies of scale. Now, we could discuss a whole report on why is productivity growth in the region lagging. There are deep issues, has to do with informality, has to do with labor markets, has to do with education, has to do with the sort of the really deep core issues that the region hasn't tackled, that it didn't tackle in the last decade, and by some dimensions worsened, and that it should tackle in this decade because we're still growing, and as Europe shows us, tackling those issues in the context of high indebtedness and slow growth is even more and more difficult. So I would say a productivity-driven agenda accompanied by a trade agenda that removes biases within countries, that lowers transportation costs with a huge amount of infrastructure investment, and that goes at the deeper issues behind productivity would probably be the best defense that the region would have in what I agree with the report is a decade looking ahead that doesn't look as good as the decade that was looking back. So that on the sort of the real part of the report. Let me very, very briefly say a couple of comments on the financial part. One more observation on integration. I agree with what Jose Godoy was saying. The political will to do this is not there. And if you think long-term and you think historically, the Europeans developed the political will for their integration after they had two world wars. So they first went at each other twice. You know, they went to their necks. And then they realized, you know, we've had two world wars among ourselves. Let's construct a different political construct. And let's try to put it. Latin America has not had that experience. My experience with policymakers is, in general, there's a huge amount of distrust. I agree with what Jose is saying. There's a lot of rhetoric about Bolivar and integration and all that stuff. But when you go to the Nicaraguans and the Costa Ricans and Honduras and say, look, it really makes sense to have an integrated electrical system for economies of scale, where generation is here and the dispatch is here, no country is really willing to let go of the dispatch of the electricity to another country. And if you say, look, if you have the Panama Canal, and the Panama Canal is going to have these huge ships now that they're enlarging it, it doesn't really make sense to have a port in other parts of Central America. Just make a three-lane highway going up and down, and that will really lower transport cost. And then you go to Nicaragua, Honduras, or Guatemala and say, don't have a port. They don't trust because institutional setup to be able to do that. So there's a huge amount of political change that still has to do for sort of the deeper integration stuff and for a renewed concept of sovereignty in which at the end of the day what we have to think is really what we're going to mean by sovereignty in a much more integrated world. Comment on the financial side. I agree a lot with José de Gregorio's remarks. My own view is that because of the correlation issue that you bring up, the shocks, the financial shocks of the region are probably going to be correlated. So there's very little scope for risk pooling in a context in which most of the shocks are going to be coming from outside the world into Latin America. And therefore, I think the best bet for Latin America is to participate in a risk pooling arrangement that diversifies risks vis-a-vis the whole world as a whole. And I think that's called the IMF. Now, it's a very imperfect, erratic, and with still insufficiently good governance arrangement. But I think the bet that we should do is to try to improve the arrangement in such that access to insurance through an improved flexible credit line and through improved mechanisms is such that it enlarges to all countries and not as it tacitly is today, only to systemically important countries. And that the kind of exchange agreements and that are there could in fact be extended to many countries, it would provide much better insurance. A lot to be gained by improving the governance of the IMF, a lot to be gained by having more resources, and to truly transforming the IMF into an institution that can do that. That still leaves room for some arrangements for reserves along the lines of Gregorio saying. People want them for exchange rate reasons, to defend them. There's a bit of self-insurance that countries want to do. But the financial integration agenda would go, in my view, beyond this exchange rate arrangement. I think there's a lot of work that could be done by protecting agreements for investment across regions, for better regulation across the banking systems, for trying to homogenize some of these regulations. A lot of this would lower transaction costs, would lower uncertainty, and would make a little bit of integration cheaper. So let me end here. What they're saying is something we agree. In the region, the macro is much better than the micro. How long can the macro stay good when the micro is not so good? The answer is, well, now less, because the world is not so favorable as it is before. We really have to turn to the micro agenda. That, as a side resort, will produce more integration if we do the infrastructure and we do the trade agreements. And I'll end here, instead of saying all together now, would not be my question. My question would be, are we more productive now? Thank you.
Thank you, Santiago. Now, our last speaker, Moses.
So I had many of the points that have been already made. So everybody made the points, but I didn't, so I'm going to make them again because I prepared it. I'll try to be the first point is that I also want to welcome Jose back, and it's so refreshing to see how much more interesting are central bankers after they are no longer since they come back. Others, I did enjoy the report. It did bring back themes that have been long forgotten, and I congratulate you for picking the subject and finding that specific niche and bringing the conversation to something that is needed. So I like the report a lot, but I had a problem with the report, and that is when I was reading it. I was reading it on the plane as I was coming back from being part of attending the Summit of the Americas, which is the best antidote to integration that you can have. So spending time with people that talk about integration and then see that nothing happens, and then reading the report is all you need to see the gap that Jose and others have mentioned. So that is a very powerful message that then brings you a reality check to a lot of the proposals and a lot of the possibilities and the constraints that we have. The second point that I wanted to make is how much, despite the inability of these governments to get together and do things in favor of integration, how much it has happened. There is a lot happening regardless of the governments not doing enough, regardless of the lack of infrastructure, regardless of everything that we... There is, you know, it's surprising how much is happening despite the lack of priority, attention, resources, and clarity. But having said that, of course, hard to disagree with the central message of the report that integration in the region is lagging, both to what it should be and what compared to what others are doing. That lag is explained in part by what is happening globally. Let's just remind ourselves that this is this conversation about integration takes place in the context of a world in which Latin America is squeezed between quantitative easing and yuan undervaluation. So, and massive overvaluations of the currency. So you have a region in which everyone has currencies that are overvalued, competing with countries that have undervalued exchange rates, and with massive liquidity and quantitative easing and all that. If you put all of that, it's no longer about trade, it's about something else that makes it very hard to compete, export, integrate. So talking about integration and lowering barriers and making it easier for your rivals and competitors excuse me, to export to you, given the macro setting, it's very hard. And so the surprise would have been that in this context, they would have a lot of integration happening. That's the surprising thing. So, sorry. The report just confirms that the conditions were not there for the integration. But then let's talk, that's at a global level. But then at the regional level, we need to talk about the fact that there is a massive region-wide Dutch disease. The region has experienced for a long time the effects of a Dutch disease, and others have written it, Barclays and Alejandro Grisanti, the IDB, and others have noted that this is a region-wide situation in which the Dutch disease is affecting the region in a variety of ways that are well known. It essentially inhibits the diversification of exports, the diversification of the economy, and inhibits, it emphasizes the commodity-based economy and de-emphasizes and makes life very, very hard for those that are not directly associated with the commodities production and exporting. So that is happening throughout the region. It also concentrates economic activity, concentrates income. It of course, distorts the exchange rate and adds volatility. It's essentially an added volatility and an accident-prone kind of economy that's there. But one of the more corrosive effects is, of course, the deindustrialization of the region. So we're talking about a region that is rapidly losing industrial capacity. And all the indicators are there. With a very, I think that with the small exception of Mexico, most of the countries have seen their industrial infrastructure, their industrial capabilities, their industrial output decline. So if you are talking about integration and you want to integrate and export intra-regionally non-commodities, you're left with exporting services and manufacturers. And there you have two problems. One is that you have little of that and declining, and then everybody does more or less the same things. So in the region, there is a lot of economic overlapping. There is not a lot complementarity. So if each one of the countries more or less has the same exports of non-commodities and the same non-commodity production and structure, then it's very hard to trade with people that are doing exactly the same thing as you do. And that is a very important point. And the more you deindustrialize, the more that becomes a problem. And then one of the consequences is at the industry level. So I have gone from the global level to the regional level, and now I want to talk about the industry level. One of the things that's happening at the industrial level is an amazing degree of concentration. Deindustrialization is creating concentration, and concentration means that only the big multinationals are players, increasingly. If you are a small, even large, uninational company, you have a very, very hard life competing with the big multinationals that does the same things that you do, but regionally or globally. So, you know, that's an old story, but it's worth reminding ourselves that competing against global multinationals that have global sourcing, global access to capital, capital costs and capital structures and scales that are quite competitive, it's very hard. And so the multinationals are essentially dominating whatever there is in Latin America that is non-commodities. And they trade within themselves. There is a lot. That's why a lot of the numbers that you show that are very interesting have to do with intra-company trades. These are trades that are not arm's length. They are not between unrelated buyers and sellers. They are companies selling to themselves and deciding at what price and where do they capture the profits and the margins. And they increasingly decide where to locate the different companies. That's where the transportation costs and other logistical aspects and defects that Latin America has, they're very, very critical. So in many ways, the multinationals are developing the industrial infrastructure of the region according to their own strategic plans and on the basis of where they find opportunities to avoid, evade, or exploit the difficulties that we have in transport costs and other factors, and tax structures. Which brings me to, you know, I had the point, but you made it much better than I, about infrastructure. It's very hard to have, one of the things I missed in the report is that there's almost no reference to infrastructure and bottlenecks. How can, you know, it is an important factor, and it's becoming an even larger problem. So I think Santiago already discussed it quite well. Then, despite the physical infrastructure, we have the issue of social infrastructure, which we like to call domestic demand. The idea here is that integration will also depend on how successful these countries are at stimulating domestic demand. By that, and that includes how successful they are at expanding the consumer base. And some of them have been quite successful. Chile, Brazil, and Mexico and others have now a consuming class that is far larger than it was before. And that bodes well in terms of creating capabilities domestically that perhaps can be linked to trade. But there is no evidence that that expansion of the middle class is nurturing and fueling an expansion of integration. Perhaps in services, but I'm not sure. I don't have the data. Then I also had a comment about the FLAR and the Latin American Reserves Fund. And I sympathize and agree with the intuition and the insight underlying the proposal. The notion that you will have a pool of resources and reserves, all of these countries that are accumulating reserves. So let's pool them in some way, in some proportion, and have them ready for rainy days. And that can be a very interesting anchor for volatility. It can be a very powerful tool, additional tool. So it's a very good idea that I support. But the problem is that its original seeds are not very good. So I used to be a trade minister, and also at some point I was the governor and the board of the governors of the central bank of my country. So I can imagine that you are in the board of a central bank that, and somebody comes and says, you know, we'd like to take parts of reserves and give them to Evo Morales, Hugo Chavez, and Rafael Correa. That's the fund. You know, those are the countries of the fund, plus, of course, Colombia, Costa Rica, Peru, and Uruguay, you know, the financial powerhouses of the region. So, do you, you know, vote? Would you support that proposal? It's a good idea, but would you support that proposal? No. No. And it's not going to happen. That doesn't mean that it's not a good idea to generate a system that can stabilize and create anchors and fight with the volatility embedded in the what you call the primarization of the economy, you know, the continuous trend towards relying on primary exports in the region. And finally, all we needed to know about the prospects of integration, and you mentioned about the geopolitics of it all, we could see it recently in the spat between Mexico and Brazil concerning the auto sector. If you look at the details of that, and then you say, you know, if this is what's happening between these two countries, by the way, ought to be the leaders of any integration movement. You know, if Brazil and Mexico don't take the integration banner, no one will, or others will, but it will become important. In order for something to happen, Brazil and Mexico, and the U.S., by the way, ought to be the central player in whatever initiative there is. And just look, I don't know, and I don't think this is the time or the moment or the point to make the details of that friction that escalated in ways that was disproportionate and unnecessary, but it happened. And that's what happens when you have exchange rates that are misaligned and when you have a lot of trade frictions that are associated with that and you know, trade and exchange rate misalignments that fuel protectionist instincts and countermeasures and all of that. So, central message is let's bring back the conversation about what is the model of growth that ought to be pursued in the next decade when the winds are not going to be as favorable as they have been recently? And what are the kinds of ideas and initiatives that ought to be at the center of conversations? I'd like very much the productivity, bringing back productivity as a central theme. If that happens, then that there may be some trickle down effects, or you know, some contagion to the trade and integration agenda. I welcome and celebrate the notion that the powerful idea that it's time to start thinking about what happens next when the winds stop being on our backs and start coming from the front. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I think it's the best time to open the floor for questions from the audience. Teresa.
Leaders in the region that are going for more and more protectionism, whether inside or outside, that the way forward is not by closing your economies, it's by, you know, opening and competing with the improvements in productivity, with the changes in sort of addressing some of the bottlenecks, whether they are in the labor market or whether they are in infrastructure and so on. One specific comment sort of just from the report, I mean, isn't there a contradiction between asking for more regional integration and then asking for more pooling of reserves? Because, I mean, the more integrated you are, the more your risks are correlated, and therefore the less the capacity of the region to face this shock when it comes. Thank you.
Thank you. Carlos Hurtado from the IADB. I have a comment / question for Eduardo, and I hadn't read the report, so I only saw the presentation. And that said, I think I have a problem with the message, because I think it's clear for everyone that, leaving aside the question of regional physical integration, roads and so on, but, you know, regarding trade and financial backstop arrangements and development banks, it seemed to me that you were suggesting, and this is a question, that more regional integration in those areas is better than more global integration. And if that is the case, and that's a part of the comment, that I would not agree with that. Because I think, you know, it's nice that everyone is doing well now, seems to be doing well as well in Latin America, to be more integrated in trade rather than being integrated in trade with the European Union nowadays or with the U.S. 2 years back. Yes, but I think this is a situation which is specific. I think in general, the more trade is better when it is more globalized, because it is more... it's safer to be like that, you know, because of the pooling of the risks. The same thing happens, in my view, but Santiago said it very clearly, with the IMF and the FLAR and so on. I don't know why, you know, the FLAR is a better arrangement than the IMF. It may be institutional. The problem is that the IMF may have a lot of problems and so on, but then the question is to fix it, not to create another thing which is, in my view, inferior. And the same thing, in my view, happens with development banks. You were saying, yes, CAF is better than funding themselves, the countries. But CAF is more expensive than the IADB, and the IADB is more expensive than the World Bank for this country. Now, there may be something that has to do with how you access the funds to these places, and which I'm sure it is more difficult to do it through the IADB or through the World Bank. But then that's, again, an institutional problem of those institutions. And again, you know, I mean, you have more pooling of everything in the bigger institutions. So that's the question is whether the message is that it's better to have more regional integration vis-a-vis global integration. Bueno.
Yes, we have a question on the back, and then we come back here.
Hi, my name is Julie Chan. I'm a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. I focus mostly on European, U.S. Financial and economic issues. But I would really like to take advantage of the presence of Moises Naim and some others on the panel to comment on the Repsol YPF situation. You know, first of all, if you can explain, as a former trade minister, why this situation kind of turned out the way it did. I think there was still hope until the very end that the Kirchner administration would not take the action. And secondly, what type of response could possibly come out of the EU and Spain now that this has happened? Apparently, the EU Parliament today will pass a declaration of action urging the European Commission to kick the Argentinian government out of the G20, to impose trade sanctions and take other measures, and would like to know what the possible menu of responses may be.
Yep.
Good morning. Charles Edwards here with the Embassy of Honduras. This is a question for Alejandro. With your presentation, I was given the impression that Mexico is sort of being given a choice between looking north towards the U.S. or looking south towards Latin America for more economic integration. And I was wondering if, or what your thoughts are on an integration between CAFTA and NAFTA, and that opening up the way for Mexico and the United States to sort of turn their attention south as opposed to across the Pacific.
Okay, I think we have a question here. See.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for your presentation and all of your inputs. I actually have two questions. One would expand with my name is Victoria, sorry, from the OIS. One is kind of expanding on the question of Repsol and YPF of Argentina. Like, along with that, in the context that there's been a lot of decision-making that may have been poor from the government, didn't receive the support it wanted from the Summit of the Americas. It left early. The debunking of Argentina from the privileged trade with the United States and the declarations made to the International Trade Organization, the World Trade Organization. What is the future for Argentina? How's it going to be in the future? And this, my second question is, of the Dominican Republic. I know I was actually hoping Mr. Kaufman was going to stay. I know that he was here. He was in the Dominican Republic recently. But I was wondering about the future of the Dominican Republic as well. Hipólito Mejía, the ex-president and one of the current candidates, he doesn't have a very good relationship with Chávez, who is very important for the energy sector of the Dominican Republic. And he just started off on the wrong foot with Barack Obama, since he was here recently giving remarks and racial remarks. So I was wondering what would happen in the scenario that Hipólito Mejía wins the presidential race, and what could that mean for the country and trade? Thank you.
Well, we had two questions there on the back. Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yeah, and then Tito Cordella, World Bank. Just a question for Eduardo regarding regional integration. And my question is, to which extent do you think that the existing trade agreement favor or maybe the culprit for the lack of financial integration? In the sense, maybe we have modern integrations that add agreements that foster trade diversion, and fostering trade diversion, the existing, this may be the ultimate reason why we do not have enough trade integration. So I would like you to elaborate on this.
Hi, Rafael Romeo from the IMF. I want to say something in favor of integration. I think there's been a lot of negative views on the panel, and in particular in favor of the productivity argument and the growth. I think behind the productivity story is always kind of an institutional story and a rent-seeking story. And there's a little bit in this report, but perhaps it could be expanded on in terms of the benefits of improving institutions through free trade agreements and through multinational institutions. I wonder if the panel could comment on that. It's, of course, it's been a success story for Europe. In spite of the recent crisis, institutions have improved in Southern Europe and in the periphery relative to 20, 30 years ago. And, of course, on the other hand, we have a great example of regional trade and integration between Cuba and Venezuela in the region, which is, I think, not what you guys have in mind, but is there and is also a good example of exporting institutions.
Yeah, thank you very much. Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, IPD Colombia and ODI. I really enjoyed the presentations. I'm sorry I was late. I wanted to ask about this idea of funding regionally infrastructure and also other measures to improve productivity like scientific collaboration and so on, research. It follows a little bit on the previous question. It's true that reserves have to be used for self-insurance if the origins are either capital flows, potentially reversible capital flows, and temporary current account surpluses due to, say, high commodity prices. But there may be a part of reserves now in Latin America, which, a bit like Asia, may be a more kind of resilient surplus kind, obviously not as large as China or so on, but there is, I think, an emerging current account surplus which is more permanent. And would it not make, which is sort of the basis for sovereign wealth funds, would it not make sense to pool more of that in kind of regional development banks like the GAF or an expanded GAF? Probably not the Banco Sur, but to expand the role of these regional institutions for regional public goods, again along the European model of what the European Investment Bank did in the initial phases of European growth and integration, which is quite tough to use Europe as a model now, but there are good lessons there as well. And it was very successful. So I was just wondering about whether there's appetite in the region, also politically, as Jose was saying. You know. But I think it would be an interesting moment to do this at a time when the BRICS, for example, are talking about a development bank. Could there be an intra-Latin American development bank?
Let's
or expansion?
Thank you very much. Ruben Perina from Georgetown University. I enjoy the presentations, even though I'm not an economist. But I thank you for bringing back the subject from the 60s and 70s, I guess. But I'd like to see whether you can discuss the question posed at the beginning, whether Latin America is really a region, and where do we go from there?
Okay, Eduardo.
All right. Well, first of all, thanks for all the comments, particularly from the panel. I would have liked to receive the comments previously because some of these issues, I think, are implicit there, but have not been spelled out in the report. So I need to correct that now, but I would have liked to introduce those concepts in the report itself. Santiago, education and productivity. I mean, we cannot repeat ourselves every single report, but, those are at the top of the agenda for sure, and we have said that many times. I think that we have to be a little more specific about productivity, though, although I also tend to repeat this in a broad sense when I write about, the agenda, the Latin American agenda. But what do we really mean about productivity? Of course, we're talking about human capital, education, health, social development. That all we know, and we will be also lagging behind, but we know that we have to put more effort there. But there are other issues that are less generally discussed, and one of them is infrastructure and the building of regional goods that you mentioned, which is something that's very topical. I think that the IDB has been trying to push forward with that and have been finding problems, as the ones you you mentioned as an example. I think when we talk about, when I talk about regional trade integration, I'm not talking about lowering barriers. I'm talking about the building of regional goods. I'm talking about facilitating the integration between activities, companies in the region. I think that through doing that and through exploiting the economies of scale and specialization, that can actually lead to increases in productivity. And here I have to be very specific. Let me give you an example, for instance. We have Mercosur in Latin America, in South America, right? Mercosur is essentially a traditional free trade agreement, except for the car industry and some others, particularly the automobile industry. The automobile industry is the only one in which we have actually built up some productivity gains, because it's the exception to the rule. So what is the exception? It's just a particular regime that is oriented to fostering specialization, so that you can actually build something in one country and some part in the other, and you can, through gains of scale, you know, build up suppliers. It's a key issue in our country, the lack of suppliers. Suppliers are essentially the ones that are receiving the spillovers, the innovation and technological gains from the big car companies. So this is industrial policy, essentially, associated with trade integration, and it's generating the minimal economies of scale so that you can actually produce this with some spillover that ultimately permeates other industries, because these suppliers actually acquire some skills, technological skills, human skills, that can be used to improve some other areas, not only automobile industry. That type of integration is directly geared towards gains in productivity. Jose mentioned wine. When I'm talking about natural resource intensive exports, I don't mean wine. Wine is actually it uses higher skills. It has elaboration, added value. And there are a number of spillovers and other different industries and services that actually, you know, foster productivity. I'm talking, when I think about natural resource intensive exports, I think about something very simple. We're not exporting only wine. Actually, we're exporting wine, but we're mostly importing beans. And beans is not a productivity gain in activity. So that's my concern. So we have to be very specific about productivity. I think that some degree of integration can actually foster productivity on top of whatever we need to do with infrastructure and education and such. But again, I should have been more specific in the report. So it's very, very welcome, all these comments. Regarding FLAR, again, I'm not thinking about less research. It's kind of weird to defend FLAR here, because the last report, one of our main points was the correlation risk, the fact that everybody is correlated, then there is not much diversification gains, risk pooling gains, with FLAR or any other reserve pool. And actually, this is part of the report, because this is the bad. The bad is that we have the correlation risk. But I think it's interesting, although we have these institutional issues to tackle, I think it's interesting to see the fact that through multilateralization, some of these countries that in no scenario will have access to the IMF facilities, no matter how we push for them, because half of these FLAR countries will never have access to a liquidity facility, will have access to an IMF program for sure, but that's a different issue. But they will not have access to the liquidity window. How this, through the integration of reserves in a multilateral entity, can have access to, for instance, money from the fund, liquidity from the fund. So I see FLAR as a way of actually accessing markets for countries that are not the systemic ones that typically would have or are expected to have access to IMF liquidity. I don't think, I mean, it's good what you're saying. I mean, I have been writing about the fund as a center of the global safety net, financial safety net, for a decade already. And I have followed these discussions until now. My impression is that this is as far as the fund can go. In fact, the last proposal still has not been approved because it's too ambitious. The global stabilization mechanism, which I agreed with, has not been approved by the board because of moral hazard considerations and, you know, the fact that they're giving too much power to the fund as opposed to the lenders. I don't think it's going to be. I mean, the chances that we have an actual liquidity facility that is useful for most Latin American countries and it's going to be used by Latin American countries are very, very low. So in that context, assuming that the funds cannot do more than that and taking their lead in calling the articulation of the regional agreements, I think that FLAR, despite institutional problems, can give a hand. Now, of course, if you think that nothing can be done with a country like Venezuela because of Chavez, then most of this discussion is essentially dead on arrival, because you know, if we put the institutional obstacles first and believe that the institutions cannot be improved by, you know, essentially building this new institution or fostering or strengthening new institutions and multilateral institutions, then if that's an insurmountable obstacle, integration and multilateralization has no future. I'm trying to sort of see this from the positive side. And only one more point, just to answer to Teresa, because that was a technical point. I wanted to make it very specific. She asks whether by increasing output correlations through trade integration goes against the fact that you pool reserves. And my answer to that is no, because these are different sources of risk. The shocks that affect reserves in those cases are typically global external shocks. It has no relation with the region, whereas the correlation that you mentioned is a correlation within the region. So these are essentially orthogonal. So there are correlations. There are two correlations, but they are different. I think the second one, the one through trade, has no bearing on the correlation between reserve moves. Thank you.
Okay, pretty quickly, let's go on reverse order. Moisés, Santiago, José.
Very quickly, I apologize if I sounded as an anti-integration person. I didn't mean that. It's to the contrary. I do believe, I hope that we can get more of it. So my comments were more of pointing to the obstacles. And the skepticism is because we have been talking about this now for a long, long time. And far less has happened as the numbers. And so that I wanted to clarify that integration, it should be a part of the agenda, and it's surely there. Among other reasons for some that you mentioned about strengthening institutions and creating collective action capabilities and also stabilizing rules of the game, that is very important. So that's that. On Argentina and Repsol, I don't have much to say. I have no idea what's going to happen. I wrote a piece yesterday essentially saying that I think Argentina collectively suffers from a learning disability. That's the central explanation of, you know, because it's not as if they have not tried this before in Argentina or elsewhere. They know what will happen. They know exactly what will happen. But yet they still do it. So, you know, we have an Argentinian on the table that won't comment. So that tells you. as far as responses on the part of the EU and others, yeah, you know, I don't know that the menu of options is very large. I don't believe that that Cristina Kirchner is trembling at the possibility of not being invited at the G20. I don't think they care. And the most important thing is that the surveys in Argentina show that something like 3/4 of the people surveyed support this decision. So those of you that think it's a bad idea, we're in the minority in Argentina. You know, Argentinians are very proud of what they're doing. So, you know, democracy is partly about that.
Very quickly, I think the point that Eduardo makes is point well taken, in the sense that, yes, trade could be a source of productivity gains. And I fully agree with that, because you could exploit. And the sort of productivity we're talking about here is bigger firm size, bigger economies of scale, bigger economies of scope, larger markets. Absolutely in agreement. So the point well taken there, that more integration could itself be a source of productivity gains. So I agree with that. And there was an important point made by somebody there in the audience, as integration being a source of improvement of institutions, which themselves could then help with growth. A very good example is what happened in Mexico and NAFTA. As a result of NAFTA, many laws in Mexico were modernized on intellectual property, and there was a kind of an institutional change within Mexico provoked by the free trade agreement that itself helped grow. So those two points, I think, are very well taken. And again, as Moisés says, it's not so much the one is against integration. Evidently, nobody, I think, is seriously against. We're all for it. It's just a way of how you go to it more than anything else. My last comment is on sort of the financial issue. And I understand, Eduardo, and one could certainly take a view, and there's a lot of merit to the view that says, look, it's extremely unlikely that the IMF will eventually be willing to offer kind of FCLs to all countries in Latin America because of the moral hazard issue and because of resource issue and because of the governance issue. So therefore, as a second best, we need to develop mechanisms at least for a while until that happens. That's a very fair point. And another view is my own sense about Latin Americans' view of the IMF is like all generals fighting the last war. You know, all the stigma stuff and all this stuff, I think, should sort of be put behind, and we should sort of, in a globalized world, have to look at an institution in which we should participate more, try to fight for the governance, changing the governance institution, empower it more in a globalized sense, and then carefully thinking about the moral hazard issues, do try to say you're as obligated to provide insurance to systemically large countries as you are to provide insurance to Guatemala or to Bolivia. And that might take a while. The issue is, what is the best combination of insurance mechanisms in the transition? And that's a difficult one to call. You can call it one way or the other. Stop here.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple of comments. I also have to clarify, I'm not against integration. I'm in favor of free trade and a lot of trade. So what my presentation today is a sense of frustration of so many agreements. I think that there should be a list of all agreements to foster integration. And as Moises said, well, it takes place despite those agreements. Now, perhaps the way, and this is more the conceptual way to approach, was as Santiago said it at the beginning, say, what should be the equilibrium regional trade? And this is taking, let's say, a trade approach. And how far are we from there and what we should do? Perhaps maybe infrastructure. When he talked about infrastructure, I thought about Asia. Asia is much more problematic, the transportation problem, I think, because it's much larger and they have a lot of trade. So I think that then there is the issue about building institutions and creating trust and trying to develop. But I don't know how to do it, but I think that's an area we should think more, and how even may help to redirect the efforts in the region. Then there was another question that I and Stephanie made on funding regional infrastructure, pooling sovereign wealth funds. All the things depend at the end. Governance is so important, how the things are governed. I would be very uneasy if I would belong to the Chilean committee. I won't belong, so don't worry. But there is a Chilean committee, expert committee, that decides allocation of the sovereign wealth fund. I would be pretty skeptical if I don't have an order from the president to put it in a road project in a small Latin American country. I prefer it to put it in Apple. I don't know. It's safer. So it's the way to take the risk and how we really do it in the countries is quite complicated. And on top of that, I think that given the current world, and with all the financialization and all, I think that most projects, not all of them, but I think that could help IDB, we can strengthen CAF. We have the instrument. We don't need to create a new instrument. We have the instrument, but they should operate more on the guarantee or things like that, because they should pass the private test. I think that's very important. If a project cannot get funding in the private sector, except that you find some special constraint, the first thing that you have to do is to be a bit skeptical. I think that big countries in the region, let's say the big 5, 6, they can fund everything in the international markets, and that's because they have done well things in terms of macro. So, there may be an area I wouldn't be so optimistic that we can go so far because of governance issues.
just very quickly, I think Latin America, regarding this flour issue, has not even had a common voice in the discussions in the IMF. So, I mean, it's very hard. I mean, just having a unified front on where we want to go in the IMF. So we are starting very far back, and I think as a backdrop of this discussion regarding Mexico, South versus North, et cetera, I think Mexico should at this point in time, with so many free trade agreements, definitely should just unilaterally open up the rest of its trade regime, because we have a lot of restrictions just for 10% of our trade. So it's irrelevant. It generates a mess of restrictions. And regarding this financing issue, I think, of infrastructure, I think maybe with Basel III coming in and many new restrictions in the financial system, there will be a role for international financial institutions to support infrastructure in the region, given the way the pendulum is going to swing in the other direction, and long-term infrastructure projects will be heavily penalized, at least from the banking financing side. And eventually there might be a role for projects that in other time would have been financed by the private sector that in the next few years might suffer some restrictions in their financing. And I think it's an interesting venue to explore. Thank you very much, and Eduardo.
No, just to close this, I don't want to leave the event without thanking Diana that has been helping us with all the organization. And before leaving and see her, she made a joke about OIPF, I think, because I asked her for a piece of paper and he brought me this agenda that says Ecopetrol here. I don't know how to take it. I have to check with her. But I think the story goes that after PDVSA's decline, most of these guys went to build up Ecopetrol into a dynamic company in Colombia. I hope that we don't have so many guys going to Petrobras anytime soon. Anyway. Thanks, Diana, and of course, thank you all the panelists. Have been very, very patient and very enriching in this debate. And I thank you for all your comments, and all you for coming here and being so patient. Thank you.